Good morning. Well, that's a good response. I like that. A lot more awake than during the talk yesterday. So I'm Justin Marks. I'm a senior program manager in TFS and Visual Studio Team Services, also known as Visual Studio Cloud Services, is the organization. And today, basically, I'm going to kind of follow up on what Sam's talk yesterday on the DevOps talk, and we go a bit more in depth on what our journey was like. How we transformed from being a fairly typical waterfall organization into the agile organization that we are today. To give you a little bit of math on this, today is the ninth day of the 99th sprint since we began doing agile. So 278 weeks, basically, 5 3/4 years, and we've learned a heck of a lot. What we've done today has a lot of similarities to what we did in sprints numbers 1 and 2, but we like to think that we've matured a lot as we've gone along this journey. And I'm basically going to paint the picture of what that journey looked like, and I'll also show you some of the tools that we use and how we use our own product to actually deliver what we're doing. I want this to be more interactive, so feel free. We don't have to hold questions to the end. If you've got questions throughout, stop me, put up your hand. We'll definitely go through those, and then obviously we'll have questions at the end. So, what's the punchline of the story? The developer division, Microsoft, is a very large organization. There's no single way that we've done Agile across Microsoft. Some organizations aren't Agile at Microsoft. But what I want to talk about is the developer division story. The teams that bring you .NET, Visual Studio Code, the Eclipse plugins, those teams were the first teams first organization. Obviously, there's been lots and lots of pockets of teams at Microsoft doing Agile, but it was the first organization as a whole that said, we are going to be an Agile organization. And I'll talk a bit about why we'd made those decisions. In addition, one of the things that one of the core things that we have chosen is to have a common sprint cadence. 3 weeks is our magic number. It's kind of the Goldilocks principle. 2 is a little too small, 4 was a little too large. We chose 3. We kind of stuck with it for 298 weeks. And lastly, nowhere in Agile does it say we don't do planning. Planning is still key to the way we do our work. We have top-down plans, where we figure out where the market is going, what we need to actually accomplish to be able to bring software to the masses. But we also have bottom-up plans where people like myself that are really close to this community, hearing about the needs for customization and calculated fields and all the feedback we got yesterday, how I can bring those into the plans as well. And we kind of meet in the middle to decide what we're going to bring to customers. Okay? So what is the developer division? Developer division is a very large organization. We have about 4,300 people. Those groups are everything. Emo's team for the .NET, Visual Studio, Visual Studio Code, etc. Of those, about 436 people are in team services. They're the part that are bringing the application insights, TFS, and Visual Studio team services to you. And that equates to about 35 or so feature teams. Those teams are not all located in Redmond. We are a distributed organization. We're all over the world. My team happens to be in Redmond. My boss's boss's boss happens to live in North Carolina. We've got teams in India. We've got teams in Cambridge, like Stuart. We've got people all over the world, and we obviously use technology to communicate. We tend to not have individuals in different locations. We try to have teams in locations because teams are the entities of success for us. There always are exceptions to those rules, but that kind of gives you a picture of what our organization looks like. How we deliver software is, as I said, every 3 weeks we ship. I'm assuming most of you have seen our release notes on the cloud services, even if you're not using the cloud services. But every 3 weeks, we work for 3 weeks. We have a week of our deployment time, and out the other end pops a new release that goes to you, and we shout it from the rooftops on our blogs. We talk a lot about it in our release notes, and that's how it works. We do that cycle, rinse, repeat. We do lots and lots of those individual increments, and after about 4 or 5 of them, we package those up, and we call that the quarterly update, and those go back to our on-prem product. It's not always an exact calendar date. It's not always the exact quarter, but that's the general principle. We generally have about 4 quarterly updates for each one of our backbox products, sometimes a 5th one. Assuming all of this is stuff you guys know at this point. We generally don't hold any of our features back. As soon as our features are ready, we're going to go bring those into our next quarterly update. Towards the latter half of the year, when we're starting to get to the end of the quarterly updates, those quarterly updates get smaller in scope, and then we bring those last features into the final box product, which we will brand as the next version of Visual Studio or TFS. Okay? So now it's time for a history lesson. That lets us know where we are today. Let's go back in time and talk about where we came from. It's important to know where we started from and why we decided to make the decision to be the agile organization we are today. So I'm going to use a little bit of humor on here, but this is actually pretty accurate to the way that Microsoft and as a whole has developed software. Most of the time, we do a two-year product cycle. And the two-year product cycle is broken up into a planning period and then two coding milestones. And out the other end comes our RTM product. We all celebrate. We bash cars with sledgehammers. We have a great time as an organization because we finally shipped after 2 years. And then we start the whole process all over again. Planning is basically 4 to 6 months where people like Sam and myself are stuck in a room. We sit there going through hundreds and hundreds of pages of specs. And out the other end pops basically a perfect plan with everything that we know in the world and everything we're going to know for the next 2 years, and we can hand it to the engineering team and say, guess what? Here's what you need. Go build this. Go forth and prosper. I remember when I was in the Windows organization at the beginning of Longhorn, which eventually became Product Vista. And on my desk one day landed a 100-page book called The Book of Longhorn. And it was literally the entire product plan of what we needed to go build for the next 2 years. And guess what? It took us 4. Was that the value all of you? Are you all still using Vista today? Wasn't that the greatest product that we ever released? Wasn't that exactly what you needed at the time that we shipped it? No. But that's essentially how we actually did our planning. A lot of upfront thought. And then we said, okay, engineering team, go off. And what would the engineering team do? They'd basically break down that giant document into two milestones and said, here's the work we're going to do in our first milestone, and here's the work we're going to go do in our second milestone. And the way those milestones worked was essentially 8 to 12 weeks of feature work, where basically the engineers got to have a lot of pizza, they had a lot of soda and Red Bull, and they basically coded their hearts out for 8 to 12 weeks to essentially finish the product. And then after those 8 to 12 weeks, we'd celebrate because we'd got to a point that we called code complete. And we said, great, we finished the features. Now let's go figure out what was the mess that we actually left ourselves. And we started doing things like stabilization and testing. And we found things like, hey, no one ever did localization. Nobody did globalization. Performance was now an afterthought. Oh, what about security? Oh, anything off of that yellow brick road that was the perfect happy path through the product? Oops, that doesn't work. Let's go fix that too. So we basically then spend 4 to 6 months doing nothing but bug fixing. Doesn't that sound like a great time to come out of college and join Microsoft and start working on everybody else's bugs? That's actually when I joined the company. And we'd end up having these really, really large amounts of technical debt, as Stuart was talking about yesterday. And then what would happen? We'd burn that all down. And then we'd say, great, good job, let's do it again. That was so much fun. And we'd go and spend another 6 months or so doing the exact same thing. At the end of each of those milestones, we essentially celebrate, as I mentioned. We're very big on celebrating our successes at Microsoft. And we'd ship our beta. And everyone would be like, great, I can finally get my hands on the software. And then what would happen? You would give us feedback. And what would we do about the feedback? Well, we'd say, that's great feedback, but guess what? Our organization is now fully booked up because we have the other half of the Book of Longhorn to go develop. So what can we do with your feedback? Well, what we ended up doing most of the time, as you're more than well aware, is essentially saying, wait till next release. 3 years from now, we'll get around to actually delivering the value that you've told us that there are major problems in our product. And that was essentially how not just the developer division, but the organization as a whole, Microsoft as a whole, would develop software. Windows worked this way. Office worked this way. And it was painful. It was painful for you, the customers, because you weren't getting the value you wanted fast enough. It was painful for us because we were getting great feedback, and we couldn't take action on that feedback. It was painful because we'd have competitors come in and start changing the landscape, but we were so focused on the plan that we weren't able to react and innovate fast enough. But that's how we built software. So about 6 years ago, we basically said it's time for a change. And we looked at three major reasons for making that change. Number one, we wanted to have better relationships with our customers and deliver software faster. Number two, we wanted to make sure our people were happy. Our people are our number one intellectual property. They are the reason Microsoft is successful, and we want to make sure that they can do their best work and feel passionate about the work that they're doing, and not feel, ugh, I've got to go burn down 10,000 bugs over the next 4 months. And third, Microsoft was shifting to this mobile-first, cloud-first world, and we wanted to be able to deliver services, and you can't really deliver services successfully on a two-year cadence. You can't really deliver services in this kind of a model where there's so much upfront planning that you can't react quickly. And you can't do build, measure, learn, as Sam was talking about. So those were some of the impetuses for us to decide to be agile. And we didn't decide that overnight. We didn't just have our management come in and say, guess what, we're now going to be agile. There were lots of pockets in the organization that were already doing agile. They were being agile teams or scrum teams and taking those practices. And they were telling management, we want to do this. We think there's something to this. As a side note, one of the interesting things that was custom to our own organization is we were looking at communities like yourselves, our customers, and what were you guys doing? You were being agile too. You were asking us to deliver tools to you to be able to make Visual Studio and Team Services and TFS work for your agile organizations. How would we be successful in delivering those tools to you unless we actually lived and breathed agile ourselves? So that was one of those special Microsoft needs for us to go actually be agile. But all those things combined made us rethink and transform our organization. So with that in mind, one of the big things that we hold near and dear to our hearts is the idea of alignment and autonomy. We believe there are certain core principles that the organization as a whole needs to adhere to, and that we want the organization to stay aligned on. But at the same time, we don't want those to dictate how teams operate. Teams are unique. They have culture, and that's a very, very important part of their own success. And we want to make sure that culture goes into their practices, into the way they work. So we want to allow teams to actually act as they want to act and not force them to follow specific principles. But there has to be a balance between these two, because we still need to, as an organization, roll up our information, report progress, report success, etc. So we have to balance between how much alignment we follow and how much autonomy we follow. And at the end of the day, it comes down to work items. That's one of the core places. And one of the places we want to align is around our taxonomy. We want to make sure when somebody says the word scenario, everyone in the organization knows what a scenario is. Scenario is not a card that takes 3 hours to complete. Scenario is something that, as Sam was mentioning, is an 18-month vision. It's a North Star. It's where we're trying to bring the product. Feature is our next level down. That is the individual unit that we ship. Feature, if you look at our release timeline, every one of those rows is a feature. Today, we just released the follow a work item feature. There's a lot of pieces to following a work item, but follow a work item as a feature is the thing that we're going to ship, it's the thing we're going to talk to, and it's a thing a team or a set of teams is going to act on to deliver to you, the customer. That's what a feature is. Everything below that line, stories, tasks, organization, management, do not care about. We're not going to measure how many stories did one team complete versus another. We're not going to measure how many hours of tasks were done by team A versus team B, or completed versus remaining. Those are team-level autonomous concepts. Yes, we have our hierarchy where we have stories are underneath features and tasks are underneath stories, but we don't care if teams even use them. I have one team that does very significant sprint planning and capacity planning and task breakdown. I have another team that's fully Kanban, and they actually use the feature as the thing they're going to move across the board. I don't care less which one those teams use. It's up to them. Why should I stop them from making progress and acting the way that they want? It's up to them to choose how they use the tools, and the tools are going to then support them for either one of those models. As far as planning goes, as Sam, this should sound familiar from Sam's talk, we basically have planning that follows the same taxonomy and follows the same sets of patterns. We have an 18-month plan. It's always our vision. It's our North Star. It's where we want to go as an organization. And that's supposed to last about every 18 months. But the reality is everything in our vision doc, everything in our scenarios, is not going to come to fruition in 18 months. We say we're very aspirational. We have about 60% confidence in what we define inside of our scenarios is actually going to come to market. But it's a way to keep the team focused and to be looking ahead at where we need to go. And we do those again every 18 months. About every 6 months, we call it a season. We have a fall season and we have a spring season. And the season is generally where we're really focused as an organization. We're getting crisper about what we're delivering. We're getting crisper about the features that are going to come out the other end. But again, we don't have 100% confidence on that. We're not going to go through, we don't spend the time doing all the cost breakdown to get it exactly right. We rather spend our time working on software than on accounting and doing the math to figure out, is this the perfect estimate? Can we get 100% confidence that we're going to ship this feature in 6 months? And to be fair, it's taken marketing a little time to get accustomed to this. It was not, again, none of this stuff happened overnight. We all had to learn and grow as we went through this process. But our seasonal planning is about 80% confidence is generally the way we look at that. Then we start getting to the meat of it where we actually are executing, and we call that our three-sprint plan. I, as a team leader, should know what is my team working on in the next three sprints. Is there room for change? Absolutely. Are we going to 100% to commit to every single thing we said in our three-sprint plan? No. The world changes, the features change, we find out about some debt, we find out about some other distractions that we have to handle. But for the sprint plan, the 3 weeks or the three sprints, that's only 9 weeks. That's something I can keep in my head. That's something I can drive the team towards. And it's something we can actually work at as an organization. And we have about a 90% confidence rate on our sprint plan. And then finally, you get down to the sprint itself, which is our three-week increment, and we're pretty confident about what we're delivering over the next 3 weeks. We're very, very, very focused on that. We're very confident, and that's where we're going to put, that's the place where we put the level of investment in estimation and drill down, et cetera. Okay? Questions about this? Good? All right. So let's talk, let me show you a couple examples of what this looks like. I've got to actually escape this. Oh, actually, one other thing I want to talk about quickly. The other thing that's important to know is none of this is static. We don't go for 18 months and then take a look and reflect on ourselves. We're constantly reflecting and changing as we go. We have what we call rolling wave planning. So at the end of every sprint, we reevaluate our plan. At the end of every three-week plan, we reevaluate our six-month seasonal plans. At the end of every season, we reevaluate our 18-month scenario. None of those are statics where we're just marching until we hit an end and we say, oh, great, we hit that end. The end is not important. What's important for us is learning and getting better as we go and constantly evolving our plans and our vision of where we want to be based on not only what we found technically, but what our customers are responding to, what the market is doing, et cetera. Okay, so the question is, how confident are we, how successful are we at reaching our sprint goals? Generally, we're pretty confident. Having said that, things do happen. One of my two feature teams, Sam was actually had it up on the engineering debt, was one of the red teams. Why were they red? Because they are the team that owns the technical depth of the work item tracking system. And they're a team that often gets distracted. Why? Well, when quarterly update one came out, people started installing TFS more. And when people started installing TFS more, we started to see more issues with upgrade. So one of our sprint plans a couple months ago was suddenly interrupted because we got six major customer issues that came in. We weren't expecting them. We weren't planning for them. And you know what? The right thing to do is to fix those six customer issues, fix update so we can get it in for update two. And you know what? That one sprint, we were able to easily say, hey, guess what? Our sprint plans weren't successful. Instead, we had to make an adjustment on the fly that said these six issues from customers were higher priority than the feature work, and everyone in the organization understands that. The key thing for us is adding transparency and having a conversation about why we made those changes. No one is basically saying, you said you were going to ship 7 things, you only ship 6. Shame on you. That's not the goal. We're not playing the blame game. We're not trying to basically be accountants saying, oh, well, you must hit your numbers. What we're saying is, are you making the right decisions? And I'll talk about later about how we actually do that communication. That's a very key part to our transformation. It's adding a lot of transparency. Yes? Please. So how do we figure out the right number of Scrum teams? We'll talk about that more later as well. Basically, when we do our scenario planning, we horse trade a little bit between the different teams and the different leaders to figure out what the right number of teams is to make that happen. So an example of that, we just did this in November. In November, we did a big roll. We basically updated all of our plans. And one of the things is we needed to double down on some certain areas of Agile. So we added a team. That team didn't come out of thin air. We had to make a cost-benefit decision about whether or not we were willing to take a team from another area and invest in that. Another area like that a couple seasons ago was around Git. We had one team. When we first started working on the Git project, we had one team working on Git. Well, guess what? They were able to get that feature working, but suddenly they still had to have the TF version control plus Git, plus pull requests, plus Git for the enterprise. The scope started, there was a boulder rolling downhill and was starting to get too big. And we said, you know what, we need to start looking at this and saying, we need to put more resources on this. What area of the product are we going to have less investment in, and let's go put 3 teams working on the version control system. But obviously, you have to balance that throughout the organization. And we use sprint plans as a way of giving leadership a visibility into that so we can have that conversation. And we'll go about those a little more in depth in a few slides.
You just said that you are evolving the scenario. So does that mean the scenario is also rolling forward? Or when do you start building a new scenario?
So when do we start building a new scenario? Do they move forward? Yes and yes. We absolutely are evolving those scenarios every 6 months as we're looking at the 18-month scenario plan. Having said that, some scenarios, they get closer to done. Other scenarios, based on the organization, we start realizing these are important and we have to make those trade-offs. We generally have about 8 scenarios going at any given time, but every season we reevaluate, are these the right set of scenarios? Are there new ones that we need to start coming online? And are there others that we need to basically defund, but deprioritize. Okay?
But still, that means that the scenario will be a fixed thing, basically. It's not, you are not adding other stuff into it. It's conceptually a thing that you will have finished.
At that point, it's not a scenario, it's a feature. So, an example of that would be Team Room. At one point, we thought that collaboration between engineers was a hugely important area we wanted to invest in. We didn't have a lot of area. We didn't have a lot of focus. We built the team room. We did discussions around work items. And then we realized, you know what? There wasn't a lot of desire from customers. It wasn't landing. So we said, we're going to deprioritize that. We still are working. Follow a work item is still in that same scenario, but we're not spending 4 or 5 feature teams working on it. We have one feature team doing the right focus set of work, as opposed to have a huge number of feature teams kind of like storming on the overall scenario. But the features, once they ship, they're still in the product. We don't defund them. Like another example, PowerPoint storyboarding, great feature. I don't get much feedback saying, oh, it's missing X, Y, and Z, so we don't need to have 2 feature teams working on that anymore. Yeah?
On which granularity is this done? For example, scenarios or experiences, you said you have 1 developer division working on many products, mm-hmm. And when do you decide this scenario or this feature or this story is something for product A, product B, and so on? On which level is this already decided?
Sure. So basically, when do we decide the feature, what product it's going to be associated with? What's the next train leaving the station? That's always our first thing we look at. If there's going to be another deployment, as soon as it's ready, it goes into that next deployment. If it doesn't meet this 3 weeks deployment, it goes in the next 3 week deployment. Those deployments then will accrue up into a quarterly update, and the quarterly update goes, so if it's part of the 2015 product cycle, it's going to go into 2015 quarterly update 1.
Okay, maybe I rephrase the question a little bit wrong. something like that. And when we decide, it's the same answer here valid when there will be a next release for this product and we will make it this time, the feature or the scenario will be part of, for example, another product or...
So when does a feature move from one product to another? Generally, the features are focused on a single product, or they're going to span multiple, and it's in the design and nature of the feature itself. But we're not saying, okay, Team Room was a feature for TFS, and now we're going to make Team Room a feature of Visual Studio Code. That's not generally how we do things. We kind of look at it more holistically and say, here is the scenario. The scenario is focused in this product or this set of products, and we'll build for that. An example of that would be pull request. Pull request started as a TFS feature, or a Visual Studio Team Services feature, and then eventually we had to go bring it into the Visual Studio products. We wanted to tie the end-to-end so the integrated development environment had a part of that. But we as the team, it's not, okay, guess what, Visual Studio team, go do this. The team owns pull requests, puts it in the right places. Exactly, scenarios are holistic, features are dedicated to specific products. That's a good way of thinking of it, okay? So let me show you a couple examples of how we actually do this. So I've got to actually get the screen to show something different. Come on. There we go. So this is what we call the, it's really hard to see because of OneNote is not letting me zoom, but this is what we call the three sprint planning window. My team, which is the Agile team, has six feature teams in it. And basically, every 3 weeks, we sit down and say, what's coming up next? And right now, our tool does not have a way of us pivoting this. It's something we want to go build. It's one of the next features we're planning because we're sick and tired of working in OneNote. But we figure out a way of making it work for us. And essentially, we have a conversation across the board saying, here's where we are in Sprint 98. This is what we're going to ship. We bold anything that we're deploying. And then we say, what do we think we're going to do in Sprint 99? And what are we hopeful that we're going to do in Sprint 100? And we have a conversation about it. Are we focusing on the right things? Are we making the right trade-offs? Are the right priorities across the six teams happening? And we, as a smaller group, we don't need to have this conversation in the large. We have this conversation with 20 people in the room. And all those 20 people are all of the leads, all of the PMs, and our leadership team. And we say, are we making the right trade-offs? Are we doing the right stuff? And this is a much easier way of having a conversation because it's scoped, it's focused on customer value, and you know what? If things change, that's okay, because we're going to come back 3 weeks later and have the exact same conversation, remove column one, add column four, and we have it all over again. Cycle, rinse, repeat. And part of our cadence is having these conversations at regular intervals so that we can actually adjust, we can change plans and set expectations early. What we don't want to do is say, we've gone 9 weeks, surprise, everything we thought we were going to do is wrong, and now we have to go like scramble to go figure out how we're going to communicate that, how we're going to react, are we still making the right priority changes, do we have to load balance? Like, those are terrible, terrible problems that we do not want to have to do anymore. So we have a lot of ways of communicating those things early. Oops, let me go here. Hopefully it's going to the right screen now. Good. So, another thing that we align on, aside from taxonomy, is around our sprint cadence. 3 weeks is the sprint schedule for every team across the developer division. That's not to say some teams don't do weekly sprints. If they want to do that, that's fine. But when I say Sprint 98, every one of the 4,000 people in the developer division know what Sprint 98 is. That allows us to have dependency management conversations. That allows us to have a common vocabulary. That allows us to work as a single organization and not feel like everything is off by one. That was one of the few things that we as an organization, thou shalt. And you better believe when we first made that decision, there was a whole bunch of conversation with teams like, oh, wait a minute, I'm off by 2 weeks, or I need to have a 2-week schedule. Like, those are people problems. Those are culture problems. We had to solve those individually. But that's essentially what we decided to be a core part of the way our organization does Agile. What those 3 weeks look like is pretty common. There's obviously room for change for individual teams. But essentially, at the beginning of the sprint, you do a form of sprint planning. Whatever that happens to be for your team is fine. At the end of the sprint, you're done. Doesn't mean there's debt. Doesn't mean, oh, we're done except for we haven't written tests yet. It doesn't mean, oh, we're done and it's not ready to deploy because there's a few bugs. Done means done. And then we do it all over again. Some teams do grooming throughout. My team, every Wednesday, we do a grooming meeting where I, as the PM of the team, come in and we say, hey, guess what? Let's go through our backlog. Here are the top five items. Let's review the specs. Let me give you the updates of what's going on. Anybody have any questions? Great. We're going to get to this whenever we finish the stuff we're working on now, but at least everyone's constantly in the know. Some teams do true task breakdown and upfront design planning. Totally up to the team. Doesn't matter to me which one they do. Whatever is going to be successful for the team is okay by me. One of the other things up there is what we call the magical week four. It's the dark blue box. That's one of the things that is always a little confusing, so I want to focus on that. Our deployments take time. We talked yesterday about the fact that we're trying to move into this microservice world. We're trying to break the system down. But until that actually happens, there is work to be done across the organization around rolling out to multiple canary and staging environments before it goes to production. That is not a huge amount of work. That is not work that we have to defer during the sprints. That is a rote, turn the crank, out the other end, we do the right work. And often there are problems that are found. I want to be honest about that. But it is not a fourth week of the sprint. It is not a place where you're supposed to be deferring bugs to. It's essentially a few hours of focused validation, not testing, but validation as it goes through multiple environments. And that is easily accountable for every one of the teams. You know you're going to need to spend 30 minutes as soon as it deploys into ring zero, which is our first canary set of customers, and validate that it's going to work correctly. But you shouldn't plan for work in the large during that time. Assume you have to, in general, I don't even think about that. I just get a mail from Aaron Dormeyer, who's our release manager, saying, hey, guess what? We rolled out. And my team keeps on working on the next set of features. If something comes up, obviously that's going to affect our next sprint plan. And we react accordingly. Okay? One of the key things that I think we do really, really well, and Sam mentioned this yesterday, is around communication. We believe in a lot of communication. We want to make sure that there's as much transparency as possible. And when it comes to the sprint schedule, the way we do communication is what we call through sprint emails. We don't believe in scrum of scrums. Those just did not scale for us. Instead, what we do is at the beginning of every sprint, we send a mail to everybody. When I mean everybody, I mean all 436 people in the cloud services part of the company gets this email. It's a very large group. We've actually had to, as we've gone through this, had to change where the reply to goes to make sure it doesn't reply all to everybody type of a thing. And basically that mail says, what are we actually doing over the next 3 weeks? I don't care about every one of the 35 mails I get in my mailbox, but you better believe I care about the five sister teams I have in the organization. I care about the build team because I'm depending on them on a feature I'm working on. And I can opt in to which one of those mails I focus on and which of those mails I can politely ignore and file away somewhere else in my email box. Lori Lampkin, who's our director of program management, reads every single one. Brian Harry reads every single one. Their focus, obviously, this is one of the primary ways that they get updated on what's actually happening in our organization. At the end of the sprint, we do the same thing, although it's a reply all to that mail with what we actually accomplished. And when we have conversations of like, oh, we have suddenly got six customer issues and didn't meet our sprint goals, this is the way we communicate that information, and it's a very transparent way of sharing what we have. So here, it's very hard to see, you'll see in the attached slides, but here are two mails that one of my teams, sent a few sprints ago. It's pretty clear and concise. We're focused on value. We're not focused on, originally, like years ago, I would put every single one of my user stories. The feedback we got was, I don't care about your user stories. I want to know what's shipping. I want to know what's impacting customers. So our mails now are much more focused on what we actually did, what the value we provided is. We put videos in line so you don't have to go set up a staging box and figure out how to deploy the stuff just to try it out. I've got a 2-minute video there. Lori wants to see every one of the features her organization is shipping. She looks at the mail, clicks through. Hopefully they're about 2 minutes in length. She knows everything that we did over the last sprint. This is, again, a very, very easy and lightweight way of communicating. These mails take about a half an hour to write once a sprint for the PM. Okay? So that's the how we communicate in the small. As we start moving up the scale, how we communicate in the large is what I mentioned before was our three-sprint plan. Every three sprints as an organization, we basically want to share what is our trajectory, where are we going, what's happening over those next 9 weeks. And we do that as well on a periodic basis. And the sprint plans are really focused on three key things. What's next on your backlog? What debt have you accrued and you need to start tackling? And are there any other open issues? One of the open issues one of the teams I had a couple weeks ago was, we only are going to have two developers next sprint. Because we have a lot of vacation planned, we had somebody having a baby, we had somebody going to India to get married, that's going to affect our actual track record. And that's a good way of communicating in that time. Not the norm, but those are the kinds of things we want to let management know to say, hey, we're not going to be firing in all cylinders for the next 9 weeks. That kind of a conversation is pretty clear there. That one note that I showed with the columns for each of the sprints, that is the data that rolls up into this report. In the past, every one of those 35 feature teams would have that conversation directly with management. So every one of those teams, well, basically Sam and all the other leaders in our organization would get into a room. Originally, it started as one day. Each team got about 7 to 11 minutes, and they basically answered those three questions. As the organization grew, that started to become a problem because this direct line of communication, it wasn't a game of telephone. It wasn't me telling my manager who told his manager who told his manager, and everybody sugarcoated it and put their own spin on things. That wasn't the goal. It was all a direct line. And frankly, it was great for me. I got visibility with Brian Harry once every 3 weeks or every three sprints, and we actually had a very good conversation. The problem, and this is again is one of the plays we one of the ways we learn as we go, is once we had 35 feature teams, Sam was stuck in a room for what, 3 days, I think it was at one point. That's not fun for Sam. That's not fun for Brian, and I'm pretty sure they got better things to do than sit in a room for 3 full days. So we adapted and we said, you know what, we're gonna roll this up one level. So Aaron Bjork, who's my manager, is now the one that presents for his 5 feature teams. So we scaled this by basically moving it a little bit to the middle. The problem there with that wasn't ideal. There is one level of indirection. Okay, we can deal with that. A little less visibility of me to Brian Harry. Okay, we can deal with that. But it was the right way for our organization to adapt as things changed. And that's one of the key, like if you take anything away from this, it's about adapting. It's about changing, trying new things. And when something doesn't work, try something else and learning as you go. That's kind of the heart of our culture as an organization now. So that talks about kind of the plan. There's one other part I like to talk about, which is the details. Our organization is super focused on having the right level of quality and the right experience. We don't want the product to look like 35 teams made it. We don't want to show the seams between the build team and the version control team. And to do that, we had to come up with a way of having early feedback on our experiences and our scenarios, or sorry, our features, to let management see what we're doing across the board and basically guiding us, not just from a UX, not just from an architecture, not just from an execution point of view, but across the board, see what we're doing. And that's where we came up with the concept of feature or experience reviews. So whenever we know we're going to be starting work or targeting delivery of the feature, we basically do a very, very short work back schedule. In my mind, work back is at least 2 sprints ahead of time. It's not like it's a cost-based decision. But a couple sprints ahead of time before we're going to start, I'm going to basically set up a meeting with all the leadership and all the interested parties. You better believe UX has a representation in that room and user education has a representation in that room. And I basically walk through a storyboard. It's a high level. I'm not trying to do an architecture design discussion there. But I walk through a conversation and have a conversation around what will the experience look like. Here is the feature that we're going to build. This should look really similar to what the demo is that I'm going to be giving at the end of development. And this is a way that I can get feedback, not just from my peers, but from my management team, and make sure that we're aligned on what this thing that we talk about is. What does follow a work item really mean? What is it going to look like? What is it going to feel like? What is the product we're going to ship? And it's, again, another lightweight way. It's a one-hour meeting. We do it ad hoc, as needed. I call Rebecca up and say, hey, Rebecca, I need an hour with Brian and company. Make it happen. And they have it on, they actually now have what they call office hours, where there's 2 one-hour windows a week where all of the leadership team has it on the calendar, and we basically have an Excel file that says who signs up for the next slot. It's kind of like going back to college. It works. It's a really light way of us having that conversation early and often. Okay? So that's kind of the how we do what we do bit. Questions on that? Okay? So let's talk a bit about the people. Oh, sorry, please. Are the plans so good that everyone knows how to implement it?
We usually have the problem that once we have designing UX thing, there comes questions like, how does this button behave in this scenario?
Okay.
So
what is the really what the, I'm thinking the question is, what is the level of detail and granularity we go to in those designs? Generally, we are talking about the yellow brick road. We're not talking about every error case. We're not talking about every edge scenario. Those better be in the spec. Don't get me wrong. The UX team will be involved. My team will be involved. The PMs are going to think through those. But at the experience reviews, we want to have a one-hour conversation focused on what are we going to give us? What are the majority of customers going to have? And there are very often times Sam and Brian and Lori ask pointed questions like, have you thought about this? What about a scenario that's highly customized? What about when someone's using a team field? And they're asking those questions not because they want to put us on the spot, but because they want to make sure we've thought through and we've gone through those scenarios as well. And we know that. Like, I'm not surprised when I get those questions. One of the things I often do is I prep myself for the rude Q&A. Every time I'm going to do one of those presentations, I better have thought through all those things because I don't want to be like saying, I mean, it's okay to say I don't know. I'm not going to make it up. But I want to be thoughtful about those types of decisions in my design way up front. Because the more I thought I put into it, the better the feature is going to be when we're done. So let's talk a bit about the people. So just like everything else, the roles at Microsoft have changed over time. In the past, there were three real disciplines: developers, testers, and program managers. I've done testing for 5 years of my career at Microsoft. I was a tester. That was a third area. One of the things we found, and we called this Eng21, we found that the test organization had a couple issues. One was that we were having a really hard time hiring good testers and retaining good testers. A lot of testers, as they got more successful and grew through their career, wanted to become devs or wanted to become PMs. So when you started to look at the principal and partner bands of the test discipline, you weren't getting as much talent there. Another problem was a lot of testers, to be successful, thought they have to go build new test frameworks. So we had hundreds and hundreds of test frameworks all over the company. That's not what testers are doing. Testers should be focused on the value we're building for customers. Another problem we're finding is there were too many decision makers. We had devs, testers, PMs, we had this triad model. Suddenly these meetings were having 30, 40 people in it. We wanted to keep it focused and make sure that the team was on point for making the decision and there were fewer people involved in that. And finally, we wanted to be focused on the value we were bringing to customer. And to do that, we always, when we had this developer and tester battle, it was always whose role is it? Once we started doing more DevOps, once we started doing more unit testing, a lot of the traditional testing discipline roles were falling on the engineering team. And they were suddenly saying, hey, we only have 6 people on our team. How are we going to do all this? So one of the things we thought, and there were a lot of other reasons for doing as well, but we decided to merge the development and the test, development and testing team into a single organization, which we called engineering. And the engineers were basically, there were some people that had competencies in the traditional testing role. We had some people that had competencies in the traditional development role. But over time, those two teams have shared those competencies because it's one team now. Instead of having 6 engineers or 6 developers and 4 testers, I've got 10 engineers. And it's up to them to figure out how to distribute the work. And it's been a much more successful way of working. Again, these are people. They're not cogs. There was a lot of human cultural issues that we had to go through to get to this point. And we didn't take those changes lightly. We didn't just make this change overnight and say, guess what? You're now an engineer. We did have training. We had discussions about it. We had expectation settings of how am I going to stack up against a developer at my same level. We thought about all of those things, and we had open conversations about those things. But 2 years after that change, we're a much healthier organization because we made this change. It's now one team, the engineering team, is responsible for everything about the how. They're responsible for how they're going to test, how they're going to deploy, how they're going to validate, how they're going to engineer, how they're going to architect. One team is responsible for all of that. There are a few other roles and disciplines at Microsoft, and I'll come to your question in one second. I want to make sure we think about them as well. We do have designers and researchers. They are a shared resource. There's not a designer per team or a user education person per team. They're shared resources that essentially report into the PM discipline, and the PMs use them at kind of as a contractor-based operation. We actually have a backlog of all the UX work that we need. I'm responsible as a PM for doing my design work, for doing my own UX. But when we have a new pattern, when we're not sure what the right UX is, I'm able to put it on the backlog and get a UX resource. We only have 3 UX resources for all of the Redmond teams. And we were able to share them, and they could come in for a couple days, help me with the UX, and then move on to the next thing. On the engineering side, we also have a service delivery team. When it comes to DevOps, we do mean DevOps. This is not an operations team that is going to be a tier 1 and a tier 2 support model. This is a service delivery team. They deliver the service. They own the infrastructure. They own the alerting system. They are an engineering team unto themselves, but what they're engineering isn't customer-facing value, it's engineering-facing value. So when it comes to who is the one that does the calls in the middle of the night, that's my team. It's the people who deployed the stuff that didn't actually work. They're the ones that are woken up. Service delivery supports them by giving them the tools and infrastructure to make that happen. How do we share best practices between teams?
Yeah.
We talk to each other. We very much believe in retrospectives. Each of the teams does their own retrospectives. When teams find that they found something really unique, they share it. It's more of a proactive than a reactive model. An example of that is Matt Manillo, who's one of our feature crew leads. He was one of our engineering leads. And Ewald Hoffman, who's his PM counterpart, started something new on their team as an experiment about 9 or 10 sprints ago. One of the things they were seeing was that their feature team was working on multiple features at the same time, and every time a customer-facing issue or a live site came in, it distracted the feature team, so they weren't delivering on those values that they said they were going to as often as they wanted to. So they said, what if we ended up making a shield team? What if we made a team that was focused, it was a subset of the whole team, and their only job during the sprint was handling live site issues and customer-facing problems? And if they're, lo and behold, like, let's hope there's none of those things happen, let's have them work on some of our debt. That'll be their backlog. And then we can have the feature part of the crew focused on the features. So we tried it. You know what? It worked really, really well. Their team is one of the most successful teams on fire. Like, when I say fire in all cylinders, every sprint, they ship a feature. Great idea. What did Matt do? He wrote an email, he described it, he took a little video of their sprint planning and sent it around as part of his sprint mail and said, hey, guess what, everybody? Here's something we tried. If you want to learn more, come talk to us. I have 4 of the 6 teams doing that now. So that's how we share best practices.
Did your change in organization have any influence on the architecture of the technical architecture of the product? So is Conway's law still working?
So architecture is an interesting one. We don't generally have architects at Microsoft anymore. We do have one person who is thought of as an architect. They're a very senior engineer. But we have, just like we do PM engineering and experience reviews, we also now do design reviews on the engineering part. And our engineering managers and the engineering directors are more responsible for holding the gauntlet for what the right architecture is. In addition, we have certain architectural review committees. So for example, REST. REST was something new. We didn't want every team doing a different type of REST API. So we have a committee that's made up of multiple people across the organization that are experts in this, and they kind of hold the bar. So anytime I want to make a new REST API, I, as the PM, document it. I go through with my engineers to make sure it's designed correctly, and then we jointly will present it to the committee. We have a 30-minute meeting, say, here's our new REST API, here's what we're thinking, here's our problem space and why this is the right solution, and they'll give us guidance on how do we hold it to the standards of the organization. We do the same thing for our architectural designs in the long scale as well. So those are the people. Our teams are cross-discipline. We have PMs and engineers jointly being a feature team. So each of the 35 feature team is cross-team. Those teams are generally 10 to 12 people. They're cross-discipline. They sit together in team rooms. This is my team room. My desk is over there to the upper right that's off the screen. And these generally are intact for about 12 to 18 months. Why 12 to 18 months? Well, that's generally what we're looking at is for a scenario. When we're building new scenarios or when the scenarios change, we shuffle the deck and we make new teams. How do we make new teams? We let people self-select. We do what we call a yellow sticky exercise, and there's a great blog that Brian put about this, where we say, hey, engineers, here's each of the 35 feature teams that we're going to have, and I, as the PM, stand up and say, what is our charter going to be? And my engineering lead says, how does he like to operate his team? We present those all. We have a nice bunch of cake and other food gets brought in. Everyone takes a yellow post-it note, puts it on the wall with their name on which team they want to be on, and guess what? There's our new 35 feature teams. Simple, easy, no problems. Everyone's happy. Things do change a little bit, but I think the last time we just did this in November, and three people didn't get their first choice. Not too bad. Only about 20% of the organization even bothered changing teams. Not too bad. One of the other changes we've made is teams used to look like this. I had a UI team, I had a back-end team, I had someone that was great at services. We don't want teams looking like that anymore. Teams should be talking about delivering value, delivering features, delivering scenarios. We do verticals. Every one of my teams now owns their entire stack. Every team isn't good at every part of that stack, but it's an impetus to get better at it and to learn. We don't have teams come in and load balance the work anymore. We have teams come in and pair program and coach us through doing those pieces of work. Questions on the teams and the people? Okay. So, having said all of this, there have been a lot of successes and there have also been a lot of failures. So I want to kind of be reflective on this and share some of the learnings we had. One was around bug debt. And traditionally, as I showed earlier, we'd have code complete and we'd have these huge spikes of debt. I remember a point where there was like 10,000 bugs on my individual team and when I was in the Windows organization. We had 4 months to go burn down 10,000 bugs. It was terrible. Our goal is not to look like that. It's to be the small, small little waves, making sure we don't build up debt and we're constantly attacking that as part of our feature work. It's just on the backlog like anything else. So what did reality look like? So going way back, many, many, many moons ago when I first joined the team, we had sprints 1 through 5, and we first said, hey, we're going to be agile. And we brought in agile coaches. We all learned what the words were. We learned what sprint planning was. We all sung kumbaya together, and we were all great. Let's go. We're going to be agile. And what does agile mean? We're never going to have debt. So we started sprints 1 through 5, and we said, eh, it should look something like this. Guess what reality was? Whee! And we basically said, time out. All right. This is not the organization we were looking for. This is not the way we want to operate. So we got to fix the problem. So what do? We literally took a timeout. Everyone took a knee. Everyone said, stop. Sprint number 6 is not going to be about features. If you were successful, good for you, but you're going to help us get healthy as an organization again because the organization is more important than the individual teams. And we took a timeout, and we basically said, we're doing a stabilization sprint. So sprint number 6, and to a lesser point, sprint number 7, was all about fixing bugs. And I remember that was incredibly painful because one of my feature teams was one of the incredibly healthy teams. We were literally perfect. We had 0 bugs. We had built our features properly. And we had to go in and help everybody else fix their bugs. But after we got through that pain point, nobody ever wanted to repeat that same mistake again. And we then got healthy and we started going on the waves. Now, having said that, there have been little spikes, and we're very conscious about those spikes. Places where there are large spikes is when we're getting closer to actual on-prem releases, where we might not have done as much due diligence on different types of server architectures, different versions of SQL and SharePoint installations, things like that. When it's time to ship, we're going to have spikes, and we're going to have less features, and we're going to focus a little bit more on that type of work. But in the general sense, we're always looking at having these small, smooth curves. And that's one of the reasons why we bring up the question is, what is your debt? when we have those sprint plans. And again, debt is not just about bugs. It's easy to talk about bugs, but it's also about your test debt. What have you tested? What do you need to move into the right level of unit tests instead of having integration tests? What about all of your architectural debt, engineering improvements, et cetera? Code flow is another thing that we made large changes to. Originally, we had huge branches. We'd have tons and tons and tons of code. They live on for multiple sprints. And then, crash, everything would come together and the whole organization would come to a standstill and you couldn't install anything for a period of days. And everyone went home in frustration and cursed each other out very loudly. That was the old world. One of the benefits of moving to Git, it's not only because of Git, but it is definitely a benefit of Git, was that we can make master the one true place to put all code. Generally, teams keep a feature branch very lightweight and no more than a sprint. Worst case, generally, it's no more than a week. Every week, I get into master, and it's up to that individual branch owner to get it in. We don't have these mammoth merges anymore. Another thing was feature flags. Because we're all in the same branch, number one thing we need to be able to do is ship without having all those new features that aren't done yet be turned on to the world. Sam mentioned feature flags in his talk yesterday. That's one of the big places we had to invest. The general idea is that we have a single code path, which is master. When you're going to write a new code path, you basically put a big if statement in as the first line of code you write. That if statement is backed by a database call saying, if this feature is on, go use this code. So now we have a new code path that's turned off by default. And once that code path is ready, we can turn it on selectively to our own canary accounts, to our own individual testing boxes, to individual customers in production if we want to test in production, which we want to test in production often. And when it's ready, then we can turn it on for everybody. If there's a problem, we can always turn it back off. And then at the end of the day, we can go get rid of that feature flag, and that new code is the code in master, and we can clean up our debt. So how do we manage the large number of feature flags? Number one, we don't always have 8 features per feature team. So generally, it's 2 or 3. If it's 8, great, by all power to you. It's up to the feature teams to clean up their debt. Part of their job is to test the flag on and flag off. One of the areas we don't do a good job in, honestly, is testing with multiple iterations, these flags on, these flags off. A lot of our integration problems happen because of that exact thing. We're getting better at it. But one of the things we trust teams to do is after a feature is live, and when I mean live, I mean on for everybody for over a sprint, their job is to go remove those feature flags as well, because we don't want to build up that debt. If you keep a feature flag around, there better be a good reason. That's the exception, not the rule. Yes. The feature flag is there. It's a temporary thing. The feature, while it's in progress, is reliant on that. But after that, it just get rid of the if statement. It's just part of the code base. Okay. At the end of the day, one of the big things, obviously, we believe very firmly that this helped us bring better value to you as the customer. But one of the things I care a lot more about is how, not more about, I shouldn't say that, I care equally about is that the people on the team are happier. We want them to feel like their engineering system is something that helps them get their job done, doesn't get in their way of doing their job. And that's kind of what our overall mission has been, and it's not just for our team, but it's across Microsoft as a whole. We want to have one engineering system across Microsoft. And all of our own learning has helped us build that, not only for ourselves, but also for you, which is kind of a nice benefit of working in the developer division. So, used to be writing code, customers use the code, huge amounts of time in between. Now, generally, it's 3, maybe 6 weeks from the time we start working on a feature till you guys actually get to touch it, which is a hugely empowering thing for teams. That's a huge way that we can actually attract some of the best talent. So that's one of the big things that we've been striving for. So I didn't do much demo because I was so busy talking, but at the end of the day, this is just our story. I'm not up here to represent it and say you should do it too. I think what the most important thing, if you take anything away from this, is our culture is about adapting, it's about changing, it's about planning, and when things don't work, we try something else. We do that at the team level, we do that at the organizational level. This was not the plan we set out to go figure out. We learned this over time, we adapted to this. And that's the thing I think any organization can be. I'm not saying every organization should be agile. Some organizations have contracts, they have plans, they have estimates they have to work with, but at the end of the day, there's still individual things you can be doing to make your teams better and more successful. And that's what we're passionate about, that's why we're building tools to help you do that, and that's why I was giving the talk today, to hopefully inspire you a bit to say, hey, maybe we want to go try one of these ideas, or maybe there's something in here that we have a different idea, but we can actually learn from. So I'm always available. I love talking about this. I do it all the time. Feel free to email me if you want to have a quick phone conversation about this. Obviously, I'll be around for the rest of the day as well. But I'm Justin Marks. I'm happy to talk to you more about this. Thank you. Any other questions? Yeah. How do we publicly document our software, or how do we internally document it? Internally, we write code comments. It's not just the comments. We try as much as we can to put the documentation in the code. Honestly, we want the code to be readable. We want to be able to understand it because that's going to outlive all of us. We also have a lot of wikis that we have done internally. VSOwiki.com is now our public-facing, it's not public, but it's external-facing wiki, and we put tons of stuff in there. All of our processes we document, all of our telemetry we document. We basically, it's not as good as we can be, but it is living documentation. It gets better every day. But it's definitely a place that we've put engineering effort into making better documentation, because it matters. Last one who read it that finds a problem is responsible for fixing it. Really, that's the way it looks like. Anytime, I mean, even I've gone through and I was like, oh, I want to set up a box. I follow the document, find something's wrong. Okay, I'm going to go fix it because I don't want the next person to have the same struggle. And if there's stuff missing, people should go at it. People are empowered to, there's no lockdown where only certain people have to go. There's no approval process. Every person in our organization has the power to go fix those docs. So Visual Studio doesn't ship every 3 weeks. It ships a lot more often than it used to. It's quarterly now. How do we get feedback? We have multiple feedback channels. The primary feedback channel is what we call Connect. It's public, connect.microsoft.com. It's a public-facing website. You can file bugs there all you want. We also have telemetry such as Watson, where every time Visual Studio crashes, we get information. We have telemetry baked into the product, so we can get quantitative information. We also care a lot about the qualitative feedback. And one of the big places we get our qualitative feedback from is around user voice. So we have our user voice site. This is the one for Team Services, but you can see there's one for Visual Studio, Visual Studio Code. That's another avenue that we have for getting qualitative feedback. We also have Send a Smile, so this little smiley face button in the upper right-hand corner. Every single one of those gets triaged by a human being and gets put onto somebody's backlog, and they're responsible for addressing that feedback as well. So there are multiple avenues for getting that feedback and for us to respond. That is, I would say about 20% of the work we do is around feedback. And some of that is new feature development, but it's often driven by feedback like this. Build, measure, learn. Yeah. How do you find out if the feature you just implemented in one sprint is... So how do we do build, measure, learn for Visual Studio? We dog food. One of the big ways we do that is before anybody touches a copy of Visual Studio outside the company, people inside the company are testing it. We update our boxes weekly, if not daily, with the new copy of Visual Studio. So we're the first ones. We, as the group of 4,300 people in the organization, are dogfooding that extensively. In addition, we have avenues where we have periodic updates externally, not to the public, but to our MVP and a smaller set of community, where we can actually get more feedback that way. There's a little less of build, measure, learn externally because it's more of a rhythmic release, but we definitely do that internally as much as possible. I know when when we did the identity work for Visual Studio, that was a place where we had a lot of iteration, and we were learning quite quickly because of that. Other questions? Yeah. That was about our ratio, about 40%, maybe 30%. It doesn't mean we don't do the same amount of testing now. We should be doing the same amount of testing. It's just done in a different way and by different people. It's the engineering team is responsible for that. One of the benefits for us for making that change is done now does mean done. It's not sprint A, we build it, sprint B, we test it. We're not throwing it over the wall. We're not doing mini waterfall. We are building and testing side by side. Before we start execution, we generally have the PM spec, our storyboards written. That's the first thing. And the next thing that comes out is both the test plan and the dev design. What format that is, that's a little different per team, but that's upfront planned and they're parallelly executed. Unit tests are generally done by the engineering team and the integration tests are generally done at the last step, but that's how we essentially operate. So our sprint schedule is the same. So sprint 98 is always sprint 98. It's not sprint 98 and sprint lions. They're all one sprint. People generally do not switch teams during the sprints. There's always people leave the company and join the company. So there's levels of attrition and change there. But when you're on a team, you're on a team. There are very, very few individuals that are our shared resources. Like we have one person that's responsible for big scale testing. Like just big scale testing. That's his job, stress testing. But otherwise, people are dedicated to the team and they're a resource of the team. How the team uses them is up to them. I've got one team, the one I was talking about, the team that had the FNL, the feature team and the shield team. They actually rotate whose responsibility is what every week. So this week I might be on the feature. As soon as it hits Friday, I go on to the shield team. It's up to them to make that decision. Are we using SharePoint? Absolutely. So we use SharePoint. I use SharePoint for document storage. That's where I store all of my specs. So every one of my specs, actually I'll show you an example of that. Every one of my specs is actually showed on SharePoint site. And if you look at our list here, which is this is our backlog. This is the Uber backlog for the team. Actually I'll show it to you as a board, it's a little bit better. This is our team's board, showing what features are where. This, I think Nino was showing this with Arthur yesterday. If you look at one of these, I'll open the checkbox control one. If you look at the links, you'll see a storyboard link. And there's our spec. It's on our SharePoint site. And you can double click it, and that way it's one place when the engineers are working on this, they know where it is. Whoever's rewriting release notes can find it. Whoever is our manager that wants to find the specs to review it, they can find it. One-stop shopping. This board here is kind of the center of our world. Everything I need to know about the feature is honestly found on this screen. It took some work to get everyone coached into doing the right thing, but now that we're doing it, it's amazing how much more efficient we are as a leadership team and as a PM team because of it. Questions? Yeah. How accurate is the team's time estimation? Estimates are inherently bad. We all know that. The longer the team works together, the better at the estimates are. We are not, for the majority, most of the teams are not doing task or hourly breakdown. They say this is going to take about a sprint. And when they generally the general cost that we like the unit of cost that we talk about is two people working for a single sprint. So a feature generally is going to be two or three of those units. That might be paralyzed in a single sprint. It might go over multiple sprints. But that's generally the way it works. Most of the time, we try to scope the features down to something we can complete end-to-end within under two sprints. That means for the time you start, it should be shippable 6 weeks from then. Sorry? No, honestly, we did a lot of planning poker and task breakdown, things like that early on. Many of the teams, as they matured and got better at doing this, moved away from it and moved more to a Kanban style. So it all depends. I have teams that still do story planning. Absolutely, they still do planning poker and actually put true estimates there, use forecasting in the product. Many of my teams don't, though. Anything else? Okay. If there's anything else, I'll stay up here, but on with the show. Thanks.